Yeah. Ray, let's get started with the current situation in the Middle East. We had Israeli attack on Iraq, in Syria, on Gaza, the assassination of the head of Hamas in Iran. How do you find the situation right now in the Middle East?
People have to be careful about assassinations. I expect Iran to retaliate big time for these last two, the head of the political arm of Hamas and one of the senior military leaders. Within one day, the first in Tehran and the second in Beirut. And I would warn what comes of these things. We have Trump, for example, exhibiting pride that he assassinated Soleimani. We have one of the establishment journals in the United States, Foreign Policy, with a major article this week weighing the pros and cons as to whether we should assassinate Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. I mean, when ironically Netanyahu tells Congress that the world is past to barbarism, well, that's not quite what it means, but he's right on that score. A major magazine just kind of weighing the pros and cons of assassinating the head of Russia. Now, I want to put this in context because the Iranians and Hamas and Hezbollah have been measured, have been careful not to cause a not to give a reason for all-out war. But at the same time, they have retaliated in ways that have forced the US and Israel to retaliate. I want to go back to the end of March 2004. Now, the US was still scurrying around in Iraq trying to find those weapons of mass destruction, right? I mean, hello, Rumsfeld would say, Iraq is as big as Texas, so give us some time, give us some. Well, they never found the weapons of mass destruction. Worse still, they were supporting the Israelis and what the Israelis did in full exploitation of the situation after 9/11, what they did in the West Bank and in Gaza. Now, most people don't know this, but one of the founders of Gaza, actually, he's considered the founder, 1987, I think it was. What's his name? Yassin, Sheikh Yassin, okay? An old guy, crippled in a wheelchair, mostly blind, but the spiritual leader of Hamas, the founder of Hamas, one of them. Now he's after Friday prayer, he comes out and he's killed by a rocket from an Israeli helicopter. And now this is the kind of indignity, like the ones just this past week, that really cause problems. What happened? Well, 9 days later, the Blackwater people lost their way in Iraq, and as you probably know, they were killed. By whom were they killed? Well, they were killed by insurgents, Hamas sympathizers, who had on the side of their trucks the brigade for Yassin, okay? Yassin, a spiritual leader. We're the brigade here. I made a note of it at the time. What is it they said? Yeah, the Sheikh Yassin brigades, okay? Now, what happened after that? Well, these were Americans, right? They're being dragged around. Their body parts were being shown on TV. And so this Sheikh Yassin Revenge Brigade, which was on the side of these trucks, They did their work, and the U.S. had to respond to that. Of course, we, eye for an eye, and what they do, they ordered the Marine general in charge of the area around Fallujah in Iraq to have at it. Send his Marines into Fallujah and decimate them. General Conway did so reluctantly because he knew he wasn't prepared. He lost about a handful of Marines, and then the White House said, "No, stop, stop, stop." It's April. It's an election year. You better not keep going. Wait until we win the election. And then, well, after the election, of course, they turned loose not only Conway, but everybody else on Fallujah. And if you look at Fallujah today, you'll see that because of that wrong turn these Blackwater people took, and because of their being killed, all manner of death and destruction and deformed babies, depleted uranium, all kinds of chemicals used by these troops. You don't want to be in Fallujah anymore. It was bad enough then. Now you see the results of these deformed babies. So what I'm saying here is that Sheikh Yassin was the spiritual founder of Hamas, the spiritual leader, and the Israelis decided to do him in. Now they've decided to do, it's clear they were Israelis, to do in these other two people. What's that fellow's name? Haniyeh, Ismail Haniyeh, who was the negotiator. Okay, he was not only the political head of Hamas in Qatar, but he had been the prime minister of Palestine after the voting in 2004, 2005, when Hamas beat the PLO, beat the Palestinian Authority. He was temporarily head of that whole unit. And just to give you some idea, that this is not some sort of fellow that grew up in street fightings. He has a PhD, okay, a PhD in Islamic and other studies. He became dean of one of the universities in Beirut, widely respected. It's not like this guy was a surgeon before he was born, although his parents were among those expelled from Palestine, from their homes in the Nakba, okay? And he grew up outside of Palestine. And of course, he drank in all the indignities that the Palestinians have suffered. So this is just a long-winded way of saying this tit-for-tat stuff. And even if the Iranians or if Hamas does another tat for this last two tits, then we're in trouble because there's no guarantee that someone can control the cycle of violence in the Middle East. Now, the last thing I'll say is when Netanyahu was here and gave that speech before our joint session of Congress, most people thought that was pretty abusive, and I did too. He showed no give, and of course, the applause, the standing. I mentioned this before, I think, but I go back to watching the Soviet Union, and when Soviet dictators, first secretaries or general secretary, whatever they were, when they made a speech, there would be 3 pages of Pravda, of 6 pages, devoted to the speech, right? And every 4 paragraphs or so, there would be a little italicized in parens, a little comment, "Borni aplodismenti," which means stormy, stormy applaudissementi, stormy applause, everyone stand. Now, that was maybe 4 times for an hour and a half speech by a Soviet leader. Well, we have 53 times in Congress. So, the way I put this thing together, Netanyahu thumbs his nose at Biden, goes down to see Trump, and comes back to Israel and he says, "Look, we have carte blanche to do whatever we want. We have the full support of Congress. Congress is what counts. It's an election year. They all want to get it reelected. They all want the money that we give them through AIPAC. And so we got it made. So let's assassinate a couple of people and let's see what they do. Now, what will they do? Now, the Israelis say that they're going to go up against Hezbollah in the north, in southern Lebanon. Most military analysts, the ones I trust, say that will be suicide. And last time the Israelis did that, they lost, okay? And they face a much better armed, better prepared foe in Hezbollah today. All kinds of missiles, all kinds of capabilities they didn't have way back 15 years ago, okay? So what does Netanyahu have in mind? Is he going to do it anyway? Well, my reasoning is probably yes. And why? Because he can talk to these other Israeli leaders and say, "Didn't you watch me on TV before Congress? Didn't you see the 53 standing applause, burni applaudissementi? Didn't you see all that? Okay, we have it made. We'll go against Hezbollah." And the army will say, "Oh my God, we're not prepared. We couldn't even beat Hamas in the south. So don't do that." And he'll say, "Don't worry about it. We got guarantees." Okay. And so, how can the US possibly prevent Netanyahu and his coterie of right-wingers from starting a war with Hezbollah, which is even more possible now after these assassinations? The only thing that I can conceive of, and what I've tried to suggest around and about, is that the US administration, Biden, whoever, speaks out very strongly and says, "Look, if you get involved in an open war with Hezbollah and Lebanon, we're not going to support you." Now, there have been little gingerly attempts to say that by some second-rate US officials. But what Israel needs to hear, what Netanyahu needs to hear, is a definitive statement saying, "Look, we, the United States, do not want a wider war of the Middle East. We don't want you to go against Hezbollah. And if you do, we are not going to support you." Okay? Now, has that been forthcoming? No. When Netanyahu got back, the Israeli press was full of stories that he had carte blanche to do whatever he wants. Okay? And even after one of these assassinations, what's his name? Austin, our defense secretary, was quoted as saying, "No, we still support. Without, we support Israel full throttle." Okay, so it's very, very precarious now, because there's a lot going for. Well, there's a lot that Netanyahu has to worry about, not least of all his juridical, his legal problems. If he is deposed or if he loses, he could end up in jail. He and his wife, maybe they have a bridal suite ready for them in an Israeli jail. So this is nothing to look down and nothing to minimize. The danger is there, and the U.S. has the capability to stop this. But if you're depending on people like Blinken, and Sullivan, avowed Zionists, not only of Jewish heritage, and Sullivan has Jewish heritage as well. Jacob Sullivan, that's why he goes by Jake, I think. And of course, Biden himself, an avowed biggest Zionist there can be. Well, they will support Israel, and they will tell Biden and the military, "Look, this may be what we need: full-scale war. Put those Hamas and Hezbollah people in their place, and that will be disaster because we don't have the capability of doing that." And if Israel is put on its back foot and threatened with what these people can now do to Israel, including Hezbollah. Israel has a nuclear weapon, okay? Would they use it? My God. I hate to think of that, but Colonel Doug McGregor, a good friend of mine, says that, yeah, he thinks they would probably use it in extremis. So, wow, it's very volatile. It's understandable. These people feel really strongly about Hamas, and this fellow was pretty much a saint for Hamas. He was not involved in any active shooting or any of that kind of offensive activity. He was their political leader, and as I mentioned before, he was the person that was doing the negotiating for release of the hostages. So, as the I think it was the head of Qatar said just earlier this morning, he says, "This is really interesting. If you want to negotiate the release of hostages, so you shoot the Palestinian negotiator, that doesn't make much sense." Well, it makes a lot of sense if Netanyahu's objectives have little or nothing to do with the release of the hostages, but have to do with genocide. And I use that word advisedly. Death by starvation, by medical plague. That's what's happening now in Gaza. And when people say, well, 39,000 people have been killed already at Gaza. What? That isn't the half of it, folks. Those are the people that they can pull out of the rubble and identify. Okay, they got names, and they put the names and they add them all up. 39,000. It's only 39,000. Well, guess what? How many people are still in the rubble? How many people are not counted? Well, there's a very reputable British medical journal organization called The Lancet, and they reconstruct all these figures. And 2 weeks ago, they said, we think the number of Palestinians killed is 186,000. So the big thing is about 39,000. Yeah, those are the identified ones. The Lancet is saying, all told, it's more close to 186,000. Now, the Lancet laid out its methodology, okay? And none other than John Mearsheimer, political science par excellence, looked at these figures, looked at the methodology, and said, yeah, I agree. It could be as high as 250,000 Palestinians killed since October 8th. Now, that's genocide, pure and simple. And I've been talking this week about specifically the outbreak of polio, 200,000 cases of severe diarrhea, even suspected hepatitis coming in. Polio had been eradicated in Gaza decades ago. It had been a problem, but actually, the Israelis hired two Stanford doctors and had to come in and say, well, we have a real problem in Gaza. It's the inoculations, the vaccination's not working real well. And so they researched it, and they found a very simple solution. Give them double. Give them two vaccinations instead of one, okay? And that did it, okay? And curiously enough, a couple of years later, when polio broke out in Israel, they know what to do. The Israelis just gave them two shots rather than one, and the whole thing was eradicated. Now it's present. The virus has been detected in sewage, in human waste, and the conditions there are inhuman. Everybody says that, including the UN. But what can be done? Well, the US can stop applauding Netanyahu and start holding the reins on him and saying, no more, don't get involved in a wider war. We will not support you. But just the opposite impression is being given to Netanyahu by the likes of Sullivan and Blinken, and of course, Biden, to the degree he's in the game still.
Ray, did Washington know that Israelis want to assassinate the head of Hamas in Iran beforehand?
Of course, Blinken says, no, they never told me anything about this. Now, the Israelis are quite capable of doing these things on their own hook. I mean, the favorite expression is the Israelis have chosen always to prefer asking for forgiveness after the fact rather than for permission before the fact. They did that actually in June of 1967 when they launched a preemptive war to preempt something that wasn't really there. In other words, the Israelis were. The Egyptians were not really threatening to attack Israel. And Menachem Begin, former prime minister, admitted that to the New York Times in 1982. So he said, look, it's clear that Nasser was not threatening us, the troops, and that was not a threat. We decided to start the war, and we should be honest about that, says Menachem Begin. Do Americans know that? Probably not. Do they know that after the June War in 1967, the UN Security Council unanimously, with the US voting for this, condemned the Israeli attack on Egypt, Syria, and the rest of it? Do they know that the UN Resolution 242 called on the Israelis to vacate? To leave the occupied territories? They don't know any of that because it's not been in the press, but that's been the law. That's been the UN Resolution 242. It was unanimous, as I said before. The date was November 22nd, if memory serves, 1967, the same year. And the Israelis had been able to get away with just thumbing their nose at such resolutions. And even more recently, to my huge surprise, the US representative at the UN said, well, such Security Council resolutions are the ones we don't like are non-binding. That was never adduced before. They're binding. That's why they set up the Security Council. That's why after World War II, the United States, in a different frame of mind, to prevent this kind of thing from ever happening again, set up the International Court of Justice, set up the International Criminal Court, okay? And to their credit, other countries like China, like Russia, like most other countries, they take these structures seriously. Now, maybe it's worth mentioning that the International Criminal Court has applied for indictments, warrants for the arrest of Netanyahu and Gallant, the defense minister. Now, that goes back about 2 months. Now, are they serious? Apparently, they are. Are they encumbered? They were. The British will say, oh, no, wait a second, we have judicial objections to this. And so, but now they've withdrawn those objections. So, given this latest, not only assassinations, but the famine, the human-induced famine, the fact that people are dying without medical help, I think the ICC, the International Criminal Court, will actually issue these indictments. And what will that mean? Well, they won't be empowered to go in and fetch Netanyahu and Gallant, and bring them to justice. No. But neither will be able to travel abroad. This happened before to Bush and Rumsfeld when they wanted to travel to Geneva and Paris right after the Iraq War. Judicial papers were served against them, and Bush decided not to go to Geneva. Rumsfeld was already in Paris when he heard that the procurator had been served papers that they should arrest Rumsfeld, who was still there. He hightailed it out to the airport and got on the first plane home. So these things are real enough. Whether they'll make any difference on the way Netanyahu behaves, the answer is no. Unless the US shows some restraint here and shows some willingness to rein him in, up till now, he's gotten exactly the opposite message. And that's really too bad because it's only the US that can rein him in.
Ray, if I'm not mistaken, this is the first time in modern times that the funeral of a Sunni leader is being led by a Shia leader in Tehran. And what does it have to do with what's going on between Sunni and Shia right now in the Middle East?
I'm sorry, Nima, I didn't catch that question. Could you repeat it once again?
Yeah. I'm talking about that this is the first time it seems to me that the funeral of a Sunni leader is being led by a Shia leader. What does it have to do with what's going on between Shia and Sunni right now? It seems that they are getting together.
Well, they have a common enemy, Nima. I think that's the short answer. And I would expect still more collaboration among them. When you have not only Moscow, but Beijing, the scene of groupings of various Palestinian and other people from the Middle East trying to get together, that's big. The Chinese are not going to just be fooling around with trying to do stuff. They must have some reason to believe that they can meld these two groups. Now, the history is really hard to, it's really hard to remember, but back in 2006, 2005, Condoleezza Rice decided that it would be really good to have elections in Palestine, you know, the West Bank and Gaza. And she was warned by her advisors, that's a little risky. You might not like the results of that election, you know? She said, oh, no, we're a democracy. Well, they had the election. Guess who won? Hamas. By a percentage point? No. They won big time. Why? Because the Palestinians realized that Hamas was not bought. Was not corrupted by the Israelis, that the PLO leadership, that was the PLA that was ruling the West Bank, had been not really square with the Palestinian people. And that Hamas had done things like, they build hospitals and they do food banks and they take this Islamic tradition seriously. We're supposed to help the poor, you know? And that's why they won the election, okay? And hands down, okay? So then what did Condoleezza Rice do? Well, this is all laid out in a Vanity Fair article, which people, if they're interested, really read. She enlisted the CIA to do a coup so that they could prevent Hamas from doing this, and it failed, okay? That's what happened. That's the background of all this. And Hamas continued to take care of the people in Gaza while the PLO continued to diddle and just do the bare minimum of doing helping the people in the West Bank. Now, push has come to shove. Hamas is incredibly popular among the Palestinians for what they did on the 7th of October. And now the Chinese and the Russians are trying to get them together so there's some sort of coherence, because that's what is seen to be necessary to face down the Israelis without the Israelis being able to play one off against the other or to corrupt the process in voting and that kind of thing. Then the Palestinians would have a chance to get their own autonomy after all this is over. That doesn't look right, good right now, but as the Palestinian, as the Hamas leader, his name, Haniyeh, as he said several times, look, martyrdom is good. You know, it coalesces forces behind our movement. And, you know, if you look at his family, 20 were killed a couple months ago, 10 more, the two of his sons were killed just a couple months ago. And one of his sons who survived says, my dad told me that he's going to be killed and that I should take encouragement for that because it's the blood of martyrs that will seed this revolution that'll be necessary to coalesce Palestinian forces and face down the Israelis because there is as much of Palestinians as there are of Israelis. And once the U.S. realizes that it cannot win this, and stops supporting Israel, hopefully they say, we should be able to get our own homeland back. That may take another decade, but we're in it, and we're ready to sacrifice to achieve that end.
What do we expect from Iran and Hezbollah, in your opinion? Are they going to respond the same way that they responded to attack on Iranian consulate in Syria?
No, Nima, I just don't know what form this retaliation will take. It could be literally an eye for an eye. The Iranians and Hamas do have the capability, I'm sure, to take out this or that Israeli leader. I tend to think that that won't be the response. I think what they will do will be a military response in some way. That will be enough to demonstrate that we're not going to be able to be pushed around anymore. No more assassinations, okay? No more killing of our nuclear scientists, because next time we're not going to be so cool and cautious. I think the Iranians and Hamas are fully aware that the game here is for Netanyahu to provoke such a situation as to make it impossible for the United States in an election year to avoid becoming directly involved militarily on the part of the Israelis. Now, if that's what Netanyahu is counting on, people say he's crazy to take on Hezbollah. My God, he's crazy. Well, crazy like a fox, huh? If he thinks that the US will not be able to avoid becoming involved, as I say, in an election year, then he's probably right, okay? And what does that bring? The US involved? Last time was involved, well, less in that kind of area when Reagan was sending World War II battleships into the Eastern Med to shoot their big guns into the Bekaa Valley in Syria. Well, that's when 241 Marines were killed in the barracks in Beirut. Now, another little sidelight to that is most people think that Israeli knew about that beforehand. And the Israelis have come close to having confessed that, yeah, they knew about it, but they didn't want to risk sources and methods, so they didn't tell the US. The US, they thought, with 241 dead Marines, would not be able to avoid becoming involved in their camp. They were wrong. They were only wrong because Ronald Reagan had some astute advisors, like George Shultz, Secretary of State, who told them, look, President Reagan, they want you to get involved deeper. It won't work. You're just going to get really mess immersed in a Vietnam casing. Pull them out. Pull them out. You take a lot of political heat for it, but we'll find some way to attenuate the damage. And they turned to Weinberger for that, who was the Secretary of Defense, says, how do we attenuate the damage? Well, oh, I know what we do. We invade Grenada. Yeah, Grenada is making dangerous signs about U.S. medical students in Grenada. Grenada, by the way, is a small island in the Caribbean. Okay, if people don't know. Well, that was a big victory. The 82nd Airborne went into Grenada and rescued those medical who weren't really in any trouble. So that was the way that Reagan faced into it and tried to attenuate the PR damage. I don't know if Biden is compos mentis or not. I don't know if he's able to rein in not only Netanyahu, but these avowed Zionists, Jacob Sullivan and Tony Blinken, who really are on Israel's side and will give Netanyahu the go-ahead for whatever the hell he wants to do now. So I guess what I'm starting to say is that if I'm right, and if the Iranians look at it that way, they're not going to rise to the bait. Okay, they're gonna play it smart, see what happens in November, make sure that if the Israelis do go up against Hezbollah, they're met with appropriate resistance, but doing things short of precipitating an open war that the US can't avoid becoming involved in other words, something really demonstrable. So, in other words, I think that the response will be measured, it will be pinpointed, it won't kill a whole lot of people, and God knows what will happen. And I think that this time the US may be one of the targets for retaliation. I'm not thinking big time. I'm thinking about those little bases that we have in Iraq, the ones that we have uninvited still in Syria. Those are things that could easily be attacked by rockets or missiles of various kind, killing some US folks. On balance, I think that the Iranians will still, and Hamas will still, not the Hamas, but the Iranians would still be loath to do that directly to US soldiers. But I wouldn't rule it out this time because many of the Iranians are accusing the US not only of knowing about this, but encouraging it. And they have, of course, Netanyahu's speech and the publicity when he came home. To cite as evidence that the U.S. is actually blessing any kind of activity that Netanyahu chooses to do.
Before the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, we've learned that Erdogan was talking about invading Israel and fighting Israel. Do you think right now with this assassination, they would change their attitude? They're gonna get more aggressive toward Israel because we know Haniyeh was part of Muslim Brotherhood and they're just a good friend of Turkey.
That's right. Yeah. Now, I'm aware of what Erdogan said. He's really good at rhetoric. They still have ties. Erdogan allows oil and other things to go to Israel. Erdogan has talked a big game. It remains to be seen whether he'll actually do anything, even though there is this, this closeness between the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. It's hard to say more than that. What he threatened was really sort of indirect. He said, well, what we did in Libya and what we did in Karabakh, well, they didn't send a bunch of soldiers into Karabakh, maybe some in Libya, but so it's mostly rhetoric at this point. Now, if it gets worse, if it becomes a regional war, then all bets are off. Then I think that that Turkey and perhaps some other Arab states will be too embarrassed not to join the fray. And that's one of the things that should worry our policymakers. And one of the things that once the US was in militarily, Netanyahu would think, well, that would be the end of any Turkish or other thoughts to get involved militarily. The US is guaranteeing us we can do whatever we want and we're safe. We'll just continue to do what we want.
Anthony Blinken says that we need to put an end to the conflict in Gaza. But at the end of the day, do you fund any sort of policies right now in the United States that is pointing toward this goal and putting an end to the conflict in Gaza? It doesn't seem to be that way.
Nima, I hate to be so simplistic about this, but it is Netanyahu's avowed aim to get rid of the Palestinians. Now, that means to exterminate them. That means to kill them or drive them out of Gaza. And that has been his policy and the policy. The openly avowed policy of the rightist people in the Israeli cabinet to whom he is beholden. Now, the proof is in the pudding. If the British Lancet is right, and if John Mearsheimer is right, you've got maybe 200,000, maybe 250,000 Palestinians already dead. Okay. Now, what's happening now? We have a UN report about the outbreak of polio, extreme dysentery, some hints of plague, or there are all kinds of infectious diseases that are attacking. Now, well, how about the medical facilities? They're all bombed to hell. There are no hospitals standing in Palestine. So, you don't have to be a direct hit from a bomb. You could be a little kid walking around in the debris, step on a nail, okay, and have no antibiotic to prevent that nail thing from infecting you and actually doing away with you, okay? So that's one thing. Now, what about the trucks coming in with supplies to Gaza? The UN put up a graphic which showed that while normally before the October events, the October attack by Hamas, there were an average of 500 trucks a day necessary to supply Hamas with, to supply the Palestinians in Gaza with enough food and medical aid and all that kind of stuff, okay? Now, recently, I'm looking for the graphic here that I had just a minute ago. It shows that, it shows that the number of trucks daily, let's say starting in February, something like 89, as opposed to the 500 that are necessary. February, June, July. July, I think it was 91. And then, now it's down to 54, almost nothing. Okay. Now, when you get almost nothing, whereas before you had 500 a day, okay, and these are UN figures, mind you, okay, then you have famine and medical emergencies, self-induced by other people who are preventing the entry of supplies. And it wouldn't be, well, it would be equally bad, but the Israelis openly said, Gallant, this defense minister, said a couple of days after October 7th, he said, look, we're going to prevent food, water, medical care, we're going to fuel, we're going to prevent it all. That's going to be our policy. Well, that's genocide, pure and simple. And it's not just rhetoric. Again, I cite the Lancet figures. I think it is probably about 200,000 already killed. Now, does Netanyahu and the leaders of Israel want to do away with the rest of the Palestinians? The answer is obviously yes. Is there anyone to prevent them from doing that? Not unless the US says, look, we're going to stop the provision of military aid unless you stop. And there's no inclination, because of the strength of the Israel lobby in this country, in the United States, there's no indication that anyone will dare say that. So, whereas in Germany in the 40s, it was little known what the Nazis were doing. You could know, but you didn't. If you didn't want to know what the Nazis were doing to the Jews, right now, everyone with an iPhone or everyone with a computer knows what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians, and there seems to be a lack of courage on the part of enough Westerners, enough worldwide people to stand up and say, no, we won't tolerate this anymore. We will not trade with, we'll blockade, as the Houthis have already done it to a degree. And so that's what's needed. Otherwise, there will be another genocide. When you say genocide in Nazi Germany or Eastern Europe, the common figure is 6 million. Well, there are what, more than 2, 3 million people in Gaza, Palestinians. So is that any less a genocide? Of course not. It's genocide. And the extreme embarrassment that I feel as an American citizen to see that my country is not only supporting but enabling genocide, that cuts to the quick. And I just wish there were some imaginative idea that I had that could help stop it.
Ray, recently we've seen that China has tried to bring all these Palestinian groups together in order to have some sort of agreement toward solution in Gaza, maybe two-state solution. Don't you think that this assassination, one of the main goals, main objectives of this assassination was to sabotage, just to destroy that agreement?
Well, it could be. Although when I think about that, to the degree it fosters a resurgence of Palestinian solidarity, I think it just as easily worked the other way. The Chinese have had remarkable success with diplomacy in the Middle East. This would be doing the impossible. But, thinking that Iran and Saudi Arabia could work out a decent arrangement, that was considered impossible, right? And the Russians are doing the same thing, trying to get these factions, these Palestinian factions together. Now, there's a lot of bitterness. Of course, most people know that Yasser Arafat was murdered, poisoned, okay? So people remember that, and not everyone was all together in pointing that out and reacting to it. So there's a history that will have to be overcome, but the Israelis, by their actions, seem to be fostering the consolidation of these Palestinian factors. And don't forget that there are as many Palestinians in diaspora as there are in Gaza, and there's a really big segment of those in Saudi Arabia working the oil fields. Okay. There are many in Syria, of course, and Jordan, Iraq. And so, although these governments have been very timid so far in their support for Palestine, it could be that finally, with this or that outrage happening, that the people rise up and say, look, we want you to do more than rhetoric. Even Erdogan might be challenged to say, it's very nice what you're threatening and all this, but how about cutting off all economic ties with Israel, huh? How about that? You don't have to send troops in here, for God's sake. Why don't you do something real rather than just rhetoric? So it may come to that. On the other hand, the US has still has all kinds of power with these governments there, those people in UAE and Qatar and all those other places, that and Saudi Arabia, of course. So it's problematical, but over time, that's possible on the horizon.
Ray, today we are having the exchange of 26 prisoners between the Russian Federation and the United States. How do you find this type of activities right now? What we can say about the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, I see it as a good sign that the US and the Russian security services are empowered by their respective governments to work out this kind of deal. I mean, for the simple fact that that requires negotiation, right? It requires talking to one another. Now, to the degree that can happen at that level, well, you wouldn't have to be a Pollyanna to think that it might be able to happen at more senior levels. I think the Russians are really open to such discussions. But what they get in response to saying, look, here are our terms, let's talk, what they get in response is F-16s. Now, F-16 fighters from fighter bombers from the US are said to be in Ukraine now. Just an hour ago, Peskov, the PR fellow, the spokesman for the Kremlin, for Putin, said, okay, F-16s, very nice. They will be destroyed. Now, Reuters is saying they will be shot down, implying that they won't be destroyed until they take off and the Russians fear an attack. But the word in Russian means in English destroyed. So my guess, they will be destroyed on the airfields where they have the bad judgment to land in Ukraine. Russia has complete air superiority in Ukraine. They have intelligence that you can't believe in terms of timeliness and accuracy. I would expect as soon as an F-16 is sighted by Russian intelligence, it will be destroyed. And again, it was explained very early on by Putin himself that F-16s are nuclear capable, okay? And the Russians will not wait to find out whether this F-16 has a nuclear weapon under its wings. They're going to destroy it on the pretense that they have to be careful here, that they have to assume that there's a nuclear weapon on that thing. Meanwhile, the Russians themselves are exercising, again, for the third time, what they call non-strategic nuclear weapons. Non-strategic, those are tactical, those are low yields, low yield in comparison to what could be. They're still very devastating. Low yield nuclear weapons. Well, what the Russians are trying to say is, look, Jacob Sullivan and Tony Blinken, you're wet behind the ears. This is the first time that US and Russian forces have been engaged with each other, even if it's a proxy war in Ukraine. We know who we're fighting. We know your avowed aid, your avowed aim is to give a strategic defeat to us. That's what your defense secretary said, for God's sake. So, look, this is the first time that it's come to this kind of situation since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And what John Kennedy said after sweating through that crisis with Khrushchev also sweating, Kennedy came to the realization that there has to be a better way. And he suggested that better way in his famous American University speech, in which he said lots of things like, let's treat each other as human beings. Our children breathe the same air. We have the same hopes for our children. And more important, the worst thing you can do as a nuclear power is threaten another nuclear power with a choice between humiliating retreat or using nuclear weapons. Now, Nima, most people don't realize that that has been avoided. Even at the, since the Cuban Missile Crisis and since that speech, the US and Soviet Union, now Russia, have been very perspicacious. I mean, it makes sense. You don't want to back another nuclear power into a choice between humiliating retreat and using, well, that's what's happening now, okay? Because of what's happened in Ukraine, the US is faced with that choice. The Russians are moving very deliberately. put it very clearly, they are not out to get a lot of territory. They're out to destroy the Ukrainian army, which they said initially that one of their principal aims is demilitarize Ukraine. They are doing that. Okay. Now, here's an election year, 3.5 months before the election. The Russians have offered terms that say we're willing to negotiate. The Ukrainians have done some strange things, like say, oh, yeah, we have to end the war before the end of the year, and let's send our foreign minister to Beijing to see if he can ask the Russians to give us better terms or whatever. So there is some stuff going on, but it's not enough. And the Russians are on the march. The Russians have the high cards. And the way they see it, nothing is going to happen before the election. And so what is Putin and what are those leaders going to do? Are they going to face the United States with a humiliating retreat? I don't think so. I think they just keep going, kind of going way. They got the initiative now. Just going to keep going until November and see what happens then. Okay. Meanwhile, I guess I mentioned the F-16s arriving. That's big. Okay. We'll have to see now whether the Russians destroy these on the airfields, as I predict, or whether Reuters is right in saying they'll only shoot them down once they're up, you know. Shoot them down means that, okay? That's why I asked my friends in Moscow to give me the Russian word for shoot down, and it's destroy, okay? So it's not shoot them down, it's destroy. That would include, in my view, destroying them on the airfields, many of which have already been pockmarked to the point where F-16s can't even think of landing. Now, all these things are ridiculous gestures by an administration that wants to appear tough. And, you know, if you, this is relevant here, if you look back, when were F-16s, when did they become a big issue? Well, I'll tell you when. Remember the fight for Bakhmut, where the Ukrainians threw everything they had, tried to defend the Russians from taking over Bakhmut, a big strategic point there, and failed? Now, you may remember when Zelensky came to Congress, joint session of Congress, and he gave them a flag, and they put it up, and it was signed by the people that were defending Bakhmut, and that's gonna just really be great. Okay, now what happened? Well, Bakhmut fell to the Russians. Now, Biden happened to be out in the Far East at one of these conferences. What happens? Zelensky flies out, I think it was in Tokyo. He flies out to meet the president and he says, Joe, sorry, but we lost Bakhmut. And Biden says, well, what are we going to do? And he gets the idea, well, how about F-16? We talked about F-16s. He's got no military advisors with him. Who's he got with him? Blinken. So he says to Blinken, how about F-16s? Blinken says, sounds good to me. That's how they're all come about. The next day, Biden gets up and says, all right, we'll show them. We're going to send F-16s. Now, that's symptomatic of the planning process with respect to United States mechanisms for foreign policy. If Lloyd Austin was compos mentis, or if he was able, or if he had the courage or the knowledge to say, Mr. President, this is not going to help anything. The Russians are going to shoot him right out of the sky if they don't shoot him on the ground. This is not going to be a good idea. He doesn't say that, okay? He doesn't even object when the president comes up with this cockamamie idea. Hey, let's build a pier outside of Gaza. Yeah, that would be a good idea. We'll get those people in Cyprus to send the supplies and put them on this pier. And then, oh, that'll be great, you know? I mean, that was so stupid. And of course, it's all a fiasco now. Why didn't the military say, look, we're the best military engineers in the world, but we can't do that, okay? So don't ask us to do that. There's no military that can stand up to that because all the generals got to be generals by saying, yes, sir, sure, we can do that. And they can't do that. There's several examples of that. So what will they do now? Well, if Putin is as perspicacious as I think he is, he won't give them this choice between humiliating retreat and using nuclear weapons. But he's under a lot of pressure too, okay? And there's a chance, I'd say less than 50-50, but there's a chance that they will decide to give the US a humiliating defeat, requiring a humiliating retreat in Ukraine. And what will Blinken, and what will Sullivan suggest to the president at that point? Well, as I said before, my real fear is that they have nothing left. They don't have even F-16s that are going to be that are going to be destroyed. Oh, but we have these low-yield nuclear weapons, okay? Now, that's a possibility. And in my view, that's exactly why Putin is in his third tranche of exercising these very ostentatiously at one point with the Belarus, okay? And so what Putin is trying to say is, look, dunderheads, we have these things too. So if you're thinking about dropping one of these things so that you don't lose in Ukraine, in other words, if you choose not a humiliating retreat, but rather using nuclear weapons, well, we got them too, and you won't escape retaliation. Actually, we've been exercising them. Our troops know exactly how to discharge the orders that I will give them. That's what Putin's trying to say, okay? Now, the problem is that Putin, nobody, not me, not anybody, has any confidence that that message will get through to Sullivan and Blinken. And even if it did, they have so much riding on this election, personal stake, because of what they did to Trump last time around. Demonstrably, what they did. It's on the record. It's in congressional testimony. It's very clear that Sullivan, for example, was the intellectual author, intellectual in quotes, of Russiagate, which is completely discredited now and a disaster. So that's what's at stake now on Ukraine. I just hope that the worst can be avoided. And I think chances are that the Russians will avoid giving this kind of choice to the United States. The Russians are not going to use nuclear weapons. Why would they? They're winning, right? So this whole thing about nuclear is real enough, but it needs to be looked at, in my view, in this context, and not in the notion that the Russians are going to use them, except to deter people like Blinken. And so if Blinken and Sullivan tell Austin, hey, dust off those tactical nukes. What's Austin going to do? My God. Oh, okay. All right. Well, my generals think maybe that's not a good idea, but all right. Well, the period didn't work, and F-16s all obliterated. It's just really crazy. And the best chance, of course, is nothing happens until the election, and then we'll see what Mr. Trump or Ms. Whoever wins the election, what they'll do. So it's very precarious to have a situation so volatile in Ukraine and in the Middle East and in the Far East. The last thing I'll say on this is that we haven't talked about China and Russia, but they flew a joint bomber patrol up against Alaska. My God, what's that all about? Well, there used to be patrols during the Cold War, right? Patrols like that, although not up against Alaska. Okay, they didn't go into the zone that there would be a violation, but they went real close. Okay, And they ostentatiously did this, announced it, and everything else. Okay. And then they had this big Navy Day. Let's see, it was just 5 days ago, I think, on, it was in St. Petersburg. And never before has there been such a congratulatory thing for the Russian Navy. Russian Navy didn't used to amount to anything but a capability to protect the littoral, right? Now it's very different, especially with submarines with ballistic missiles. But the point is that at this great Navy Day celebration, it was not only Russian warships, but there were Chinese warships, two of them, an Indian warship, an Algerian warship, and 30 dignitaries invited high-level Navy and governmental people to join in the celebration, all of whom came. So, talk about Russia being isolated. Well, there was another manifestation of the fact that no, they're not isolated at all. Even on Navy Day, they're not isolated. So we had Chinese participating in that for the first time. The last thing I'll say is on this part is that Russia sent some warships down to Havana, Cuba again. Okay. So this is the second time in a month or so. What's that all about? Well, you don't have to be a crackerjack analyst to figure out that the Russians are saying, look, we can do what you've traditionally done in sailing around the South China Sea and the Taiwan Straits and the Baltic and the Black Sea and all that. We can do that too. And we have the right, we're going to assert that right. And, all right, Monroe Doctrine, forget about Monroe Doctrine. That's not embedded in any international law. We respect international law. But Monroe Doctrine doesn't qualify, so we feel free to do whatever we want. And besides, we're really happy that Maduro won again in Venezuela. So the Russians are feeling pretty cocky. One thing I want to go back to Soviet Navy Day. Correct me if I've already said this, not now, but in our last meeting. Putin said something very interesting about, what used to be called INF, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces. They're the ones, the medium and short range missiles that were in place during the 80s, 1980s, okay? In place in Europe and in the European part of Russia. They had the range to reach each other's cities and nuclear forces within about 10 minutes. Okay. They were in place. On the Russian side, they were SS-20s. Okay. In place with the warheads and everything. On the US side, European side, Pershing 2s, US controlled intermediate range ballistic missiles. So giving the other side about 10 minutes rather than the 25 minutes traditionally enjoyed warning time between, well, ICBM warning time, all right? So what happened? To his credit, Reagan came around to respect Gorbachev as the real deal. So Gorbachev says, hey, who needs these weapons? Why should we be on such a razor's edge here, giving each other 10 minutes to decide whether we're under nuclear attack? Let's destroy all these weapons. And Reagan looks around. And I was around in these days. So Reagan looks at Weinberger's defense secretary and said, what do you think there? What do you think? And Weinberger, nah, the Russians, never, no, I can't do this. And he looks at his national security advisor there, no. Then he goes to George Shultz, okay? Now, Shultz, about one of the smartest guys I ever briefed, okay? Now, what Shultz said is, well, why don't you try it? Why don't you talk? Why don't we talk to Gorbachev and see what he really means here? I mean, it would be really quite extraordinary, wouldn't it? I mean, look, it would be unprecedented to destroy a whole class of nuclear weapons. My God, let's see, okay? So he was supported by the vice president, who happened to be named George H.W. Bush, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a terrific guy, General Vesey. Okay. I briefed all these people during the first 4 years of the Reagan administration. So they start talks and they give Shultz the action here, and he finds out they're serious. Okay. Long story short, 1987, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty is concluded. And guess what? They destroy the SS-20s in place and the equivalent, the SS-20s and the Pershings. And my friend Scott Ritter was involved in that. I mean, he went up to Siberia, for God's sake, at this godforsaken place for 2 years and worked hard to make sure that the Russians didn't cheat. And they didn't cheat, unlike with the ABM treaty, where they tried to cheat and we caught them, okay? We negotiated that one away. But so they're not above cheating, but Scott Ritter and that group was hell-bent and determined not to let him cheat, and they didn't. Okay, so they destroyed all these things, something most people, including me, never thought could happen. So what's the situation now? Trump gets out of this treaty, 2019, just before he leaves office. So 1987, 2019, it's 32 years, if my math is right. That's 2 years longer than the ABM treaty that George W. Bush got out of. Both of these things were bedrock, were the necessary conditions to avoid a nuclear war, to maintain a balance in terror, if you will, but a balance. So, what am I saying here? I'm saying that the US got out of that. The Russians said, "Why are you doing this?" And we said, "None of your damn business, as usual." And the US started putting these kinds of things not only in Poland and Romania, but now this is the new news here, okay? Now they announced that is the US and West Germany, the US and Germany announced that they're going to put long range missiles in Germany. Now, that shocked just about everyone. They announced that on the second of the 3 day NATO summit. Okay. Now, what's that all about? Well, they're going to put in these long range nuclear weapons. Why do the US need, why does the US need long range nuclear weapons? They don't. I mean, we have a balance of terror right now. We're just fine. Why do we need these new ones? We don't. Why do the Germans need them? They don't. So, what does Putin say on Navy Day? He says, "Oh, and by the way, I should mention this as well. By the way, the US is doing this, going to put these long-range ballistic missiles in Germany, and they'll threaten us, but we won't threaten the US. What we're going to do is put in medium and short-range ballistic missiles, okay? And that will be targeted on you guys in Germany, okay? We're not going to mess with the US. We appreciate there's a balance of terror there. But if they put these missiles in your country, starting in 2026 is what they agreed to, then be aware that although you're targeted now you'll be targeted by medium and short-range ballistic missiles. What does that get you? And the answer, of course, is it gets the Germans nothing, just more vulnerability. And so why did the Germans do it? Well, Olaf Scholz explained. He said, "The Americans asked us to do this, and so we agreed," end quote. So there you have it. And the Russians are looking at Olaf Scholz and the German situation as saying, "Look, you guys are really pretty naive if you don't realize what the game is here. The game is to make you more vulnerable, not the United States, and we will see to it that you are more vulnerable. So Putin chose Navy Day to put that in as an aside. He says, oh, sure. What else? Oh, yeah. He goes into this thing saying, look, this is what we're going to do. And the Navy will be involved in this as well. So it's a bleak outlook now. I guess one has to just say, well, can we hang on until November and see what happens then? One of the things that Trump is fond of saying is, well, let's see what happens. Well, I guess that's true enough. We'll have to see what happens. But meanwhile, there's a possibility of a wider conflagration in the Middle East. There's always the possibility of a dust-up in South China Sea or Taiwan Straits or even closer to Alaska. And the big fundamental change in the strategic situation is something that Blinken and Sullivan still don't get. And that is that whereas they told the president back in June, 3 years ago, to tell Putin, look, we appreciate your disadvantage. You have that long border, 10,000 of mile border with hundreds of mile with China. And China aspires not only to be the most powerful economic but also military power. We know that China is squeezing you, so and Biden says now, I'm not gonna say exactly what I told Putin, but there it is, So his advisors were telling him that he could exploit the hatred between Russia and China. And instead of squeezing, China squeezing Russia, it's been a remarkably comradely embrace, right? Now they're together as never before. And that's the switch in the strategic situation. Witness the fact that they're demonstrating this by running joint air exercises up near Alaska, naval exercises down near Cuba, and more joint naval exercises in the Baltic. And actually, they've done some down there in the Persian Gulf as well. So it's a different situation. And if Blinken and Sullivan still have this concept of uniqueness, of being superior to all other countries, and of course the president says that every time he gives a speech, then we're in for a real comeuppance here, because that's not the way it's going to work out, either in Ukraine, either in the Middle East, Southwest Asia, if you will, or in the Far East, because China is going to act like a major power now. And I just add that this Chinese threat, again, about 6 weeks into Biden's presidency, he was persuaded to say China wants to be the most powerful country in the world, and that's not going to happen on my watch. Quote, end quote. Well, I thought at the time, well, why couldn't we just do what the Chinese offer? And that is live and let live, What's the need to confront China here? Do they really threaten the United States? The answer is no. This is a manufactured threat, very much like the one from Iraq, very much almost identical to the manufactured threat that Russia is going to not only stop, not stop in Ukraine, but go on to Poland and the Baltic states. And before you know it, they'll be on the English Channel. Bollocks, as the British say. It's BS. It doesn't parse. And yet most Americans still believe it. And that's really the problem. The media has persuaded most Americans that that Putin is evil incarnate, sort of like Hitler, and even Russiagate, the charges that Russia interfered in the election in 2016, is rearing its ugly head again. And If people are interested in the particulars of that, they can look at a consortium news item that I wrote yesterday and should appear today, talking about how some of the worst offenders, so-called journalists who became propagandists, who used to be really good, and I name them David Corn and Michael Isikoff, are still saying that the Russians hacked into the Democratic National Committee 8 years after congressional testimony saying that that's not so, that the head of the forensic outfit named CrowdStrike testified before Congress on the 5th of December 2017 that there was no evidence, no technical evidence of a hack of the DNC emails that was so damaging to Hillary Clinton, no evidence of a hack by Russia or by anybody else. And they're still just suppressing that. As a matter of fact, that testimony, just as an example here, that testimony, as I said, was taken on the 5th of December 2017, okay? Barely a year into Trump's tenure. So what happened? The fellow who became head of that committee, the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, kept it in his under lock and key in his bottom drawer of his safe. Okay, for how long? Two and a half years. And then finally, somebody said to President Trump, "You know, President Trump, that's very damning testimony. It shows that what you're saying about this hoax is now confirmed by testimony under oath. Why don't you get it released?" And Trump says, "I can do that." He still wasn't wise to the ways of Washington. And his new national intelligence director said, "Yeah, you can do that, or you could tell me to do it, and I'll get Adam Schiff to fess up." So Trump says, "Do it." And the new national intelligence director goes to Schiff on the phone and he says, "Adam Schiff, the jig is up here. If you don't release that very damning testimony of 5 December 2017, I will." So on the 7th of May 2020, do the math, that was released together with 51 other documents, none of which made any real impact. And so it was buried in this thing. Now, it was successfully buried, but those like us who watched these things saw it and went, "God, you know, guess what?" And this is the payoff here. That was May 7th, 2020. The New York Times, Washington Post, nobody has referred to that testimony. What is it? August 1, 2024. You do the math, okay? And you'll see why Americans are so ill-informed about Russia, because this was the cornerstone. This was sort of the cornerstone. Russian hacking into Democratic National Committee. They took it and gave it to WikiLeaks and tried to destroy Hillary Clinton and prevented her from winning and gave the election to Donald Trump. They emasculated Donald Trump for the next 4 years, having persuaded the American people that that was the case. Now, my point is simply the article I did yesterday goes and exposes two of the main culprits here, David Corn and Michael Isikoff, both of whom wrote good stuff on Iraq when the Republicans were completely revealed as being culprits. But then they got what I call a Trump derangement syndrome when it came to Trump. And then they made stuff up. And they bought hook, line, and sinker, the business about prostitutes having their way with Donald Trump in Moscow and something. And they published all this stuff and they knew what they were doing. And now, with these years since, 3 or 4 years, now they're going back And their publishing stuff indicated, oh, we were right all along. Look what the Russians are doing. They hacked and blah, blah, blah. And the most recent thing appears in Rolling Stone magazine. You can click on that if you just click once. Otherwise, it's behind a paywall. So if you see my consortium news thing today, click on it once and you'll see this, this naive attempt to show everybody that this CIA analyst had it right in accusing Russia of hacking and doing all kinds of unsavory things to make Trump president. They won't quit. And the reason they can keep going is because the Americans are, my American co-citizens, are deprived of real information like the sworn testimony of the head of CrowdStrike. Now, CrowdStrike was the outfit hired by FBI Director Jim Comey to do the forensics on the Russian hack of the DNC. As I've already said, the conclusion was the Russians didn't hack, nobody hacked, but what happened actually was a download onto a thumb drive, right, by somebody with access to the DNC computers, put it in a pocket, take it over to wherever WikiLeaks put it out. So, what does this mean? This just means that the Americans are still in the dark. And so I thought that, and I had the agreement with the editor of Consortium News that, hey, it's not nice to expose people like this, but when they're so, when they're recidivists, when they not only never fessed up, but now doing it again, well, we ought to expose them. So again, didn't mean to advertise this piece, but tune into it. Probably should be up maybe this afternoon. ConsortiumNews.com, one of the best investigative journalist outlets that you can find.
Thank you so much, Ray, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
You're most welcome, Nima.